First, it's moving customer relationships and customer decisions in regard to them are moving everything toward counting customers, using data, and distancing themselves and everybody in the organization, all the humans that they're serving, pulling them away from their lives and the effect that they're having on the lives of these people. So they're moving away from caring and toward counting. Now, data does not, I don't know a way that data does not and cannot inform us about the effects on lives of people. It can only give the results of the tests that we set up. There is nothing downstream beyond the walls of the business, particularly for users and buyers, but also other stakeholders like ecosystems.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're super excited to bring you another episode. We are happy to thank our sponsor for Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. They brew an enlivening beverage from naturally caffeinated and nourishing leaves from a species of holly that you know as mate. It contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. On top of that, they support community and ecosystem regeneration, bringing together art, music, and celebrations in many locations. Stay up to date on their events at guayaki.com, and we hope you're going to check out this great beverage with your friends and family. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. Ones you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Zach.
So for this episode, we got a proposal from a tech industry marketing person. And he ended up reading an HBR article called, quote, "Building a culture of experimentation that targeted specifically online technology-driven businesses like travel and retail." So like, you know, your Amazons, Googles, and Bookings.coms and that ilk. So he commented that engineers in this company were so, in his company actually, were so excited and wanted to implement this idea immediately. So even as a marketing guy, he couldn't find a lot of fault with what was in this article. But he listens to Business Second Opinion every episode and was dying to know what we thought. So I could see, Carol, where he got excited around the idea of, you know, bringing this forward and how this will help his customers. But it did raise a lot of questions in my mind. How did it affect you, Carol, when you read it?
Well, first, let me just tell people what it is. So if they want to track along beside us, they can. It's the March and April 2020 issue of Harvard Business Review. And as you said, title of the article is Building a Culture of Experimentation. So back to your question. I was very disturbed when I read it. The primary reason is that it shows how much technology approaches to change have power to change culture. But I saw it as sliding them backward from where I think they need to go if they want to move toward being more regenerative. So I was thinking maybe we could help folks do their own analysis of these kind of programs when they come through. So starting with the idea that the premise of this article is that if you set up a culture, and by that it really looks like they mean infrastructure and resources, then people can test ideas with an organized process to see if they can improve customer conversion rates to sales and to therefore business revenue. So that's what they're after here. They believe that you can involve all workers in the process, and therefore you can work a lot faster to successful experiments and to shut down those that are failing much faster.
So, Carol, what exactly do you mean by sliding backwards? Because the sense that I got from this piece is that it's all about advancing and speeding up some kind of innovation-driven process. But what is it that I'm missing here?
Well, from my point of view, first, it's moving customer relationships and customer decisions in regard to them are moving everything toward counting customers, using data, and distancing themselves and everybody in the organization, all the humans that they're serving, pulling them away from their lives and the effect that they're having on the lives of these people. So they're moving away from caring and toward counting. Now, data does not, I don't know a way that data does not and cannot inform us about the effects on lives of people. It can only give the results of the tests that we set up. There is nothing downstream beyond the walls of the business, particularly for users and buyers, but also other stakeholders like ecosystem. The person who sent the article was excited and missed completely the effect on those entities, even though he sits on an internal sustainability council, as well as he's the marketing analyst we talked about. So I feel like it's making us want to move that process backward to counting and away from evoking caring. How in the world does this happen?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The effect of this article on me was that it had me thinking all about the ways the experiments could extract value from my customers by running experiments on them. You know, essentially, at the end of the day, giving me the data I need to capture from them. So by focusing on numbers, it turns customers into just that, dropping out any aspirations and having to be about cold, hard data. Sounds like the thinking of a machine, actually, now that I'm saying that out loud. I assume that's where we're headed today?
Yes. Now, we're not talking about not being able to capture more customers. We do. But I believe that what you just said here, dropping out aspiration, is the primary driver of getting and retaining and converting all those terms that they're counting for. So my second reason for being disturbed was something that is bad for business. It's like the opposite of more customer retention. They're working on improving current existence, what they've got right now, not on building systems, building capability, developing strategy for innovation. It's all incremental, and the whole culture is built around this incremental improvement. So there's a lot of mental, financial, human capacity resources being poured into this. I think of my mother saying to me, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So I'm sure they can get some of what they show in their case studies, better retention. But is it really good for the business, for the workforce, and even society as it plays out a bit through time? So maybe we should tell people more about what is proposed by the authors to demonstrate what we mean in seeking the effects that are actually being implanted in this approach. Could you get us started on what the key ideas of culture change are that you see, Zach?
Yeah, so there were basically four that they outlined. And the first was adopting a mindset of curiosity and a love of surprise. So the way they said that is that you evoke surprise and curiosity primarily by avoiding overemphasizing success, because this tends to lead to using familiar tools that are proven. And instead, they recommend to accomplish this by hiring the right people, followed by rigorous onboarding and empowering them to follow their instincts, and then giving them the training and tools for experimentation. Like, for example, you know, you hire only some people that are seen as able to be surprised and curious, right? And then second, you give them all the tools to enable all this. But this inherently limits this to a fortunate few while leaving out the rest of the organization.
Well, you started to answer my question, but I'd like a little more of what your assessment was of, and maybe an example of how this process plays out.
Sure. So the example they use involves assessing the ongoing monetization and engagement around a mobile game that Amazon was developing. So the focus of the experiment circled around questions of ongoing customer retention and revenue. The problem is that this narrowing of the questions led them to experiment with different levels of difficulty in the game in order to encourage more playtime and more money being spent in the game. What dropped totally out of this discussion was the means and methods they used in the first place to encourage monetization, which, looking at the game, is all based on behaviorism.
Well, yeah, exactly. And if it's based on behaviorism, which is like rats in a maze, that has implications. And one of the ways I see is what you're saying is true is all of the questions, all the experiments are measured based on internally how we're affected. not how the customer is affected, except for the data they give us back. The very nature of it drives toward internal considering instead of external considering. So what was second on your, or I guess I should say on their list, Zach?
Data is the decider, right? So if there's any question, it reconciles all conflicts because it is assumed is infallible. As you can tell by the tone of my voice, this worries me because we've all heard so much about the biases built into algorithms and their flaws. And actually, if our listeners want to learn more about this, you should take a look at the book Weapons of Mass Destruction by Kathy O'Neill. It's really good and tackles this topic in pretty conclusive detail. Data does let people contest decisions, but these data are often fragmented and drop out too much, as I noted earlier.
Yeah, and I want to make sure people got the name of that book because you said it fast. So it's Weapons of Math Destruction, right? Not math. So continuing on with what you're saying, what occurs to me is that data actually drops out caring altogether and makes it all about an internal view and an internal calculation of the results. And I mean by internal, inside the walls of the business, it's like we're the customers or not, unless people were to have it in their mind, which is what I want. I want the user or the buyer to be the reconciler as the first step. I want that in everybody's mind. And I want all debates to have caring as the decider. I think people should have debates as the first step, not about whether the data plan is right, but about the user's life and how they're about to affect it. You put the customer in the room, so to speak, even if it's only in the mind of people do there, the people who are in the room thinking about it. You can't do that with data because there's no customer in it. There's just numbers. Then the other four stakeholders, which we've talked about in other podcasts, including the co-creators, Earth, society, and the investor, are pretty much not in the room. They don't have a voice in the decision unless we put it there. But it's almost too late at the point where they have debate, which is after or just before you're going to do the experiment. And then after the point of testing and experimenting with an idea, that's a little late to talk about the customer. The debate is about an already formed plan. Lives being improved is what caring evokes. That is customers' lives. That is nowhere in this thinking, digesting, or experimenting. So I hate to keep moving, but what was number three, Zach?
Number three was democratizing experimentation. Now, okay. To be fair, I like this on the surface because the idea behind it implies decentralizing information back to the workers. But what has me questioning things a bit is the process they suggest, which involves a detailed inventory of the experiment, but no comprehensive look at the effects of those experiments. Well, beyond obviously customer retention and monetization. So now I don't mean the results, right? Results are something totally different, as I just said. I mean, how is this stakeholder's life different because of what we undertook? To me, this looks like it's about participation rather than contribution. This doesn't evolve folks' capacity to express their essence into the business, which we've talked about is the key to real innovation. And thinking of the stakeholder pentad that we use, that you'll find in a bunch of Carol's books, it also fails to build capacity in the five groups of stakeholders as the core work of the business is supposed to be doing for them.
Yeah, and also, just so I listen to you describe it, they are working out the idea of get everybody participating. So it's a participation model. And those are very seductive. You train people, you organize around work, you give them some resources, but none of that really evokes caring or the capacity building it takes to really be able to think about the customer's life. It tends to use current and new skills, all of which are driven by data, but doesn't evolve the scope of their thinking or considering. I think people have to be bound to real lives. Ultimately, and each day, I want every member of every organization I buy from to be connected to a greater purpose and meaning. The initial change it seems we need here is knowing people deeply who count on us for more than just satisfying some momentary need they can do a customer survey for and giving me a product or service, like at the point of sale. Customers have aspirations, and that leads them beyond just a need for the moment. experimentation must be tied to their lives, not computer-generated data that measures the outcome for our business, our internal business. That kills the soul to me and the very meaning of work. This sounds terrible, but it's a bad use of surprise and curiosity. Be surprised how well we did for ourselves. Data and our ability to follow its lead can only give so much satisfaction and pretty much no meaning. So it feels to me a lot like what we've called before a machine culture, not a regenerate life culture, because it's not about things that are alive. So I'm afraid to ask this, Zach, but what's number four?
Okay. So there's one last feature of number four. It's called democratizing experimentation, which they tout. This one's all about transparency. And I found I wanted them to be more transparent about customer lives, right? For sure. And have us all feel that we can see them deeply. That takes more work than just shared access to spreadsheets and printouts and results and then pushing for the next improvement.
Yeah, I agree with you. Transparency is a big deal. But to me, where it really matters is, and it's more of an issue, is with the outside world that we affect beyond the walls of the company or the business. So we want to know who is affected by the data-driven model, and we want to be able to see the thinking that they use to get to how they're affecting us, and potentially even getting the customer involved. We've told a lot of stories about how we do that. We can speak to the alternative we always offer here, I think. That is getting to a living systems way to create experimentation that leads to a large and a rapid innovation for positive systemic effects for all stakeholders. What is counted is not the results for us, but for the outcomes in the lives of users and other stakeholders. Here's my advice. Be suspicious of any program that they try and sell your company that promises better results for the business and measures the results for the business and has a separate process in some other department to take care of any externalities, even with customers, like a separate department for customer service is what that is, and a separate one for sustainability. Anything else, Zach?
Yeah, so number four also has a new leadership model, which frankly didn't really feel so new to me, but I don't know, what do I know? It's included the idea that management's role is now to come up with new challenges that can be broken down into smaller pieces to test. They talk about building systems, resources, and organization design that fosters experimentation, which, as far as I can tell, really just means new computer systems. This is not really about culture, as they suggest and what Carol alluded to earlier, unless you're trying to create a culture that is data-driven, of course. And the incrementalization of change now comes from the top, as leaders are supposed to role model the change they want to see. Unfortunately, what gets dropped out is the critical role of ensuring strategy and execution is all integrated.
Okay, now we're back to the first concern I had with this article and this approach. It builds off of current existence, what we've already got, and we find incremental ways to move that a little bit at a time. It easily becomes not very strategic, especially when management focuses on challenges that can be broken down into manageable pieces. That's not strategy. Real innovation requires a regenerative mind, which comes from starting, let me say this again, we have several times, starting with the lives of users. What are their aspirations? What is their essence for each buyer node and what they're seeking to achieve in their life? For example, when Merit and Meridian moved away from demographic market niches and into, and by the way, all the commonalities that ran across them, they were at the beginning just selling in Pottery Barn and Crate and Barrel. So that was pretty limited.
So I assume they were offering beautiful but generic rugs for faceless buyers at that point in time and getting lower margins than generic offerings get?
Yeah, no, you're right. I should add a little to that story. When we switched the business model to buyers with faces that shared values and approaches to life and had real aspirations, everything shifted. the whole business got redesigned, not around the data we collect. I don't see any difference in customer surveys you pay somebody to do and data you collect, but we redesigned it away from the nameless, faceless customers buying generic rugs to specific high-end interior design buyers that were one of three nodes of value. The first one was trendsetters, those people who really change the course of how homes and offices are decorated. Bespoke interior designers, those that design for a specific person, unique from the ground up. And finally, eclectic designers who love to pull things together from different cultures, but find some kind of pattern. The organization reordered itself, that is Merida. It reordered itself around these, created market field teams around, focused on these three market nodes, and they began to innovate rapidly with what these groups aspired to in their clients' homes, their commercial office space. You know what the most fun things they did was they created customer labs where they brought in their customers and co-created with each nodal group separately and included in that design process their artisan designers. And their artisans were from countries around the world where this dyeing and weaving was an extraordinary thing, and they had been immigrants coming here. So they brought the rug makers in who had astounding skills that they brought with them. They were being wasted, those manufacturers, producers, weavers, dyers, they were being wasted in this incremental improvement model. Merida is not tech-driven, I agree, and this article is more about that. But the same thing has happened with technology companies like Regen Network, who's creating a new platform to understand how farming practices are beginning to behave regeneratively and how we can count on and know what they're doing. But they're using different buyer nodes who are working to find different things in that community in order to innovate.
By the way, the last part of number four I want to touch on again, as it was for the leaders to be role models, which I think is key here. So basically, be the people who show you all how to do this. In other words, everyone has the same rules to play by. So everyone's ideas are to be tested with the same data-driven process, which again, seems like a good principle, but we still have the problem of how and what they are testing and the lack of critical thinking skills being built in that process.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. The principle isn't that far off, but without critical thinking, with data being the decider, it will move you into counting, not caring. And we want to move people the other direction. That's why I said the culture is going in the wrong direction. We've repeatedly on these podcasts, my books, data, interviews, shown that this kind of approach, the caring one into the customer's life, grows more rapidly revenue and margins much faster than data and this incrementalization ever can. You have to get everyone's eye, everyone's mind, and everyone thinking about the way of working to start from the outside, from the customer and consumer, and then other stakeholders. The reason I think this is not common, why people don't do this outside view first, is that businesses have divided up work so much they can't see the whole. It's like a dissected frog put into different departments. I mean, all of which look inward. And then you have a few other people who look outward, like citizen management, sustainability management. Importantly, I think we have not built the mind of every worker to be able to hold an entire value-adding process, like from earth to earth, from idea to customer and to stakeholders. They can't hold that big a framework, so we've broken it up in pieces where what we have to do is rebuild that mind so that they can see innovation happens everywhere and is connected in the value-adding process. And we can see what we're doing in one place, how it's going to affect the customer immediately. Or when we know how we want to affect the customer, we can see what we need to do in our creative process. But here's my ultimate thought. I think that decisions are always reconciled by those affected, not those producing.
So the Merida process was institutionalized into the culture, if I think I'm following you correctly. Is that a democratized path or maybe a universalized one is more accurate? Because the Merida process starts and ends with a different premise, right? So it produces different effects and better financial returns in a market like retail, where businesses often suffer.
Yeah, so great. So keep going with that. What are the contrasting premises to what they're offering as you see them, Zach?
Yeah, so I think the customer here is the decider, not the data, right? The processes is the team who specifically knows and speaks for the customer's aspiration in their lives and what's needed next by them, the customers. Second, the driver is not data, but contribution offered up from the workers who are fired up because their connection to real people is a real thing and not an interest of surprises and being curious because they're being told to. They feel compelled to conceive and design and deliver the precise thing that matches the unreconciled aspiration of customers, which is always, always a better source of a big margin shift. And third, this has the experimentation working from the essence of each buyer or user, rather than abstract ideas about what might improve current existence. This is not pie in the sky ideas or blue skying when you start with essence.
Yeah, what you're talking about here is this approach of the essence of the business is able to be expressed also. So you're talking about the essence of the buyer. You can't, without this kind of process, express the business essence. The data decides. And you can't embed it then in the experiment. But you want every member, and get that when you've got a market team, connected to the business's essence, that is, who they work for, tied to who they serve, the essence of the customer. You know, that requires very different work systems. And they say that, and they're right about that. But they're talking about work systems designed to submit to data, not to advance and open for customers. But most organizations don't know how to do this developmental design. That's why I gave kind of, I guess I might call it a flash overview in the regenerative business. It takes a lot of work to build the mind that can think beyond existence and not to just become abstract when you do that. This is the role of essence. It's grounded innovation and grounded experimentation from the real world of customers' improved lives.
So just picking up on that last point, this is actually why we also have online live sets of workshops where we bring together a dozen or so companies over time to develop their own development-based interpretations of living systems thinking processes, which is a regenerative way to architect your business with these ideas. Where in these workshops, we teach businesses to use these principles, tested and proven for over 70 years. So if you want to learn more, check out carolsanfordinstitute.com and look under offerings. And for women entrepreneurs, consultants, and trainers, check out Seed Communities under the Communities tab just for you.
And I hope you all keep listening to Business Second Opinion for more ideas on working from regenerative paradigms and practices. Plus, I am happy to announce my new book is out March 10th, The Regenerative Life, which if you create a bulk order through my publisher, which I can help you do, you can get a 50% discount. You can get an extensive workbook and a book club with materials. Plus, I will join you online for 6 more live workshops for free, all for buying in a bulk order. You can check that out or get started at carolsanford.com.
And thanks again to our sponsors, Guayaki, and your pursuit of regeneration with high integrity. If you want to get a second opinion mug, send us your article and topic on business practices where you need a second opinion. You can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at biz_second_opinion. If we use it to get an episode, you get a mug. Also, your ratings and reviews on any platform help people find us and spread the word. Also, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter so you can get connections to the show notes and much more.
And let's remember to thank Numi Tea. They have been a dedicated sponsor for our Business Second Opinion show notes and making sure they're out. We also want to thank Babson College for sponsoring the Regenerative Business Summit and the Regenerative Business Prize, which happens annually online and sometimes in Boston. So check out the Business Second Opinion website for more information on our podcast and the Regenerative Business Prize on that website. And join Numi Tea as a champion of our podcast.
This has been Business Second Opinion.